From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Julia Louis-Dreyfus tells us about playing the Vice President of the United States in the new HBO series Veep, and about being treated like one of the guys on Seinfeld. Also, Stephen Moffat, the co-creator of Sherlock, tells us about creating a contemporary Sherlock Holmes.
The thing about Sherlock Holmes in the original is that he's very, very techno-literate. I mean, to a contemporary Victorian reader, he was a sort of cutting-edge scientist. He was well up with all the stuff. He was also born for the internet age because he loves research.
The second season of Sherlock premieres on PBS Masterpiece this weekend. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new superhero action film, The Avengers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, will forever be known to millions as Elaine Benes, the character she played for 9 seasons on Seinfeld. But she was an early cast member of Saturday Night Live and won an Emmy for Best Comedy Actress starring in the CBS series The New Adventures of Old Christine, which ran for 5 seasons after Seinfeld. Now she's starring in a new HBO comedy series called Veep, in which she plays Vice President Selina Meyer, a former senator struggling to exert power and influence from an office much of Washington regards as irrelevant and powerless. The series finds comedy in the awkwardness of the vice president's role and in the interactions between Meyer and her staff, who are alternately fawning and cynically ambitious. Here's a scene from Veep in which the vice president, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, has discovered an opening in her schedule she wants to fill. Her staff are played by Anna Klumsky, Matt Walsh, and Reed Scott.
Come on, let's go somewhere. Let's meet the public.
You want to normalize it?
Yes, exactly. I want to meet some regular normals. Where are we going to find them?
Photo op at the normals and the normalistas.
Yes, there's a book fair Adams Morgan.
No. No. You're not going to get a good photo holding a book. You need something active.
It's like kids read or something. Like, read.
Kids are unpredictable. They wet their pants.
Keep it simple.
Yeah,
keep it simple.
It's
frozen yogurt. All right, is huge in this town right now. All right, it's hot out. Let's go to a store. There's one that I know that I go to all the time on U Street. It's owned by 3 generations of African Americans. I mean, there's a narrative built right in.
Excellent.
Home
it's
run.
Perfect. Done deal.
Great.
We can totally normalize with those guys. That's what we're gonna do. Make it happen, guys.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Or should I say, welcome back, Madam Vice President?
Yeah, I prefer that.
Okay, well, we'll try and stick to that, or at least maintain a certain amount of respect and protocol.
I've gotten very used to being called that. It's rather peculiar.
Yeah, a little heady. How did you prepare for this role, being the Vice President?
I met with a lot of people on Capitol Hill. I met with a couple of vice presidents, speech writers, lobbyists, chiefs of staff in various offices, senators, schedulers, you know, the list goes on. I watched a lot of C-SPAN, and I've met some politicians, you know, along the way in my life, even prior to this project.
As you had these conversations with politicians and political operatives and staff members, give us a sense of what you learned then, or what kind of questions you asked and what tips you picked up or insights that helped inform your performance.
I'm very much struck by how insular Capitol Hill and the land of politics is, not dissimilarly from show business, to tell you the truth. You know, it sort of feels like it's the only universe when you're there. I remember a woman who was a scheduler for a senator saying really very proudly that she slept with her BlackBerry on her pillow right next to her head just in case she was needed while she was sleeping. And I thought that that was extraordinary and that she was boasting about it.
Right.
And I just thought that is amazing.
It occurs that your character is she's the vice president. We don't learn what political party your character, Selina Meyer, is. Not that much about her political career, and kind of inherently has ambitions that maybe exceed her talents. But she can't be a fool either. I mean, nobody who gets to be vice president doesn't have something on the ball and some accomplishments. I wonder, as you developed this, was there sort of a sweet spot you had to find between someone who is competent but maybe not too competent and kind of neurotic?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, buffoonery is funny, let's face it. And you'll see as the series sort of unfolds, you will see her behave competently in certain situations. But she's betwixt and between, you know. She is somebody who's used to power. She's in a powerful position, and yet she's powerless at the same time. And it has that circumstance, I play it as if that circumstance has a way of paralyzing her. So that's how I sort of justify maybe certain so-called hiccups that she has. You know, her agenda is often clashing with the agenda of the president. And how does one survive under those circumstances? It's a mess. And if it weren't a mess, it wouldn't be funny, of course. So, you know, we keep it messy.
Right, right. I thought we'd listen to another clip. In this scene, you have just, as the vice president, have just met with a senator who you're trying to get to support a bill that you're backing. And it kind of didn't go as planned. And you've just come back from the meeting and mm-hmm. are kind of confessing what happened to your staff. The staff members here are played by Reed Scott, Anna Klumsky, and Matt Walsh. You speak first. Let's listen.
Hey, I think I did the right thing, but I just need you to confirm that I did the right thing. I said something to someone.
What exactly did you say, ma'am, and to who?
To whom?
Senator Doyle said that he would sponsor the bill.
Oh.
If we keep oil off of clean jobs. And there was an implication, perhaps,
You didn't say yes.
No, I didn't say yes. I said, yeah.
Okay, well, we told oil we'd put one of their guys on clean jobs. That's why we got away with the Cutler tweet.
I know.
Okay.
She's aware
of
that. I was charmed by Doyle. He's got that little twinkle in his eye. He just niced me. I got nice. All right? And where were you, Amy, by the way? Where were you?
No, you said you had it covered.
No, I didn't have it covered. And it's your job to know that if I say I have it covered, I don't have it covered, and you cover me. I need you all to make me have not said that. I need you to have make me unsaid it.
That is our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as the vice president in the new series Veep. They're trying to straighten things out with her staff. I mean, very, very funny scene.
Thanks.
You could imagine this character as a senator when she had her own base of power and kind of more sure where she was, handling a negotiation with another senator well. But here, she's kind of undermined by her position and gets frantic and does stupid things.
Exactly. In fact, in the first episode, when she has a meeting with Senator Hallows, played by the marvelous Kate Burton, and she comes in and she says, "Barbara, what have I been missing here?" And Senator Hallows says, "Power." And there's this, when she says that, I sort of played it like it was like a punch to the gut because it was a very brief, tiny punch to the gut that was sort of relayed, but it was in fact that, because she's sort of speaking the truth, and that throws Selena off her game, and she's off her game for the rest of that scene as a result. She's sort of struggling to get her balance back, and she doesn't quite recover it.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She stars in the new HBO series Veep, in which she plays a vice president. It airs Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. You were, and if I have the story right, folks at Saturday Night Live saw you in the Practical Theater Company and invited you to join the cast at the age of 21. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, this must have been a dream come true.
Well, it was. It was because also understand that I was in high school watching Saturday Night Live when it had just begun, you know, when it was Belushi and Gildon and Danny Aykroyd and all those guys. And so I was, you know, their audience. And then all of a sudden to be, you know, however many years later, picked to be on the show was just like, it was Cinderella going to the ball time, you know.
But I gather the ball wasn't so much fun for you.
Yeah, wasn't that great?
Why not?
I was very young, okay? And I was very, very naive. And I was coming from college and doing theater work with my friends, and we would all work really hard as an ensemble to make the best possible show. So there was a sort of an earnestness that I took with me to doing SNL that really had no place. I didn't understand the politics dynamics of the show. I also went in thinking that I would just work with writers, and I didn't go in with characters that I had worked and worked and worked on. I was not a writer myself. I was somewhat unprepared. Larry David was there my third year. He was a writer on that show for my last year, and it was his only year. And we became friends during that period of time. We sort of, he was miserable. He didn't get a single sketch on. He did get one sketch on, but it was cut between dress and air. And so we sort of bonded in misery, and And there you go.
And that's what led to Seinfeld, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there was a period of time in between, but yeah, it did.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She stars in the new HBO series Veep, which airs Sunday nights at 10. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who stars in the new HBO series Veep. She's best known for playing Elaine Benes for 9 seasons on Seinfeld. Well, let's listen to a clip. This is, I think, from season 5, and it's a moment where Jerry arranged a date for you with a friend of his, and then on the date, the guy exposed himself, and you're in. You remember this one? And you're in the apartment after the date, and Jerry asks you about it. Let's listen.
Come on, how was your date?
Oh, the date. The date.
Yeah, how was it?
Interesting.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Why, what happened?
Let's see. How shall I put this?
Well, just put it.
He took it out.
He what?
He took it out.
He took what out?
It.
He took it out?
Yes, sirree, Bob.
He couldn't.
He did.
Well, you were involved in some sort of amorous...
No.
You mean he just...
Yes.
Are you sure?
Oh, quite.
There was no mistaking it?
Jerry.
So you were talking, you're having a pleasant conversation, and then all of a sudden...
Yeah.
It.
It.
Out.
Out.
Well, I can't believe this. I know Phil. He's a good friend of mine. We play softball together. How could this be?
Oh, it be. You got any other friends you want to set me up with?
And that is our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as Elaine Benes on Seinfeld there with Jerry. Gosh, what a fun scene. The premise of the bit is funny, but... the back and forth with you and Jerry and the way you read those lines are really what make it. I mean, did you practice a lot? Did you develop those different, you know, vocal inflections and expressions?
I love the compliment. Thank you very much. But I will say that I think that scene is exceptionally well written. and it was really a question of how not to mess it up. Because that was just... that was just so artful, that writing, as I was listening to it. And I remember the tricky part with that scene was that, you know, it's that scene in particular is it all about timing in a weird kind of way. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, all comedy is about timing, but this scene in particular had a rhythm to it. And then you had to factor in the laughs into the rhythm. The laughs of the audience. And I remember that night as we were shooting it, thinking, this is not as we rehearsed it because of the laughs. And believe me, I'm not complaining, but it did alter things a little bit, you know? There were pauses there that we didn't really have, as I recall, in rehearsal because, you know, we weren't holding for the laugh. But it had a sort of... It was a little bit arch, that scene, I think, the way it was written. A good arch, by the way, but arch.
Now, someone said that, you know, the character of Elaine evolved a bit over the course of the series. And someone wrote that the writers found when they started writing for Elaine as if she was just one of the guys, it somehow really clicked. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah. And I loved that. because it opened up everything. All of a sudden, we're all on the playground together, and I wasn't in a separate area. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of gender sort of not being an issue was one of many strengths of the Seinfeld show. And I think in particular, I think of the episode, The Contest, and that was the episode in which all four characters entered a contest in which they would try to refrain from masturbating. And by the way, never use the word masturbate in the entire show, which was lots of fun too.
Yeah, it's a memorable episode.
memorable episode. But what was great is that Elaine was a part of this contest. And that was just how it was.
Right.
And I was very proud to be a member of the contest. and by the way, when we were shooting that episode, I swear to you, I was every instant looking over my shoulder waiting for somebody from NBC to come and shut us down. And they didn't, inexplicably.
Well, maybe we should just listen to a bit of that scene in the coffee shop where you guys are making plans. Let's listen.
All right, I'll tell you this, though. I am never doing that again.
What? You mean in your mother's house or all together?
All together.
No, like, give me a break.
Right.
Come on.
You don't think I can?
No chance.
You think you could?
Well, I know I could hold out longer than you.
Care to make it interesting?
Sure, how much?
$100?
You're on.
Wait a second. Count me in on this.
You?
Yeah.
You'll be out before we get the check.
I want to be in on this, too.
No.
It's all oranges.
What?
It's a different thing. Because you're a woman.
So what?
It's easier for a woman not to do it than a man. We have to do it. It's part of our lifestyle. It's like shaving.
Oh, that is such a baloney. I shave my legs.
Not every day.
All right, look, you want to be in?
Yeah.
You got to give us odds. At least 2-1. You got to put up $200.
No, 1,000.
Now, I'll put up 150.
All right, you're in for 150.
Okay, 150.
All right, now.
And that's our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, with the cast of Seinfeld in a famous episode from the series. You know, after you left, there was a very funny episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David series, where Larry needs some permission from his neighbor for something, and the neighbor is a big fan of yours. And so to help Larry out, you agree to come over and meet him. And there's his wife. She's aiming a video camera at you, and you're saying, you know, gosh, I really don't like these things. And, you know, these are the kinds of things I guess celebrities have to deal with. But it occurred to me that your character, Elaine on Seinfeld, was such a sort of, in some ways, down-to-earth, you know, approachable sort of person that I can imagine people might feel more comfortable coming up to you than they might, you know, I don't know, pick a name, you know, Judi Dench or somebody. Do people see Elaine on the street and want to come up and chat just like your old buddies?
Oh, yes, definitely. People feel very comfortable coming up and talking to me and hugging me and engaging. And, of course, I understand that. I mean, I'm in their living rooms, and I get it. I really do. I'm also very short, and I think, you know, I don't have a sort of physically imposing presence, you know? And the reality is that the vast majority of people who come up are unbelievably gracious. And, you know, for the most part, I'm happy to engage. Maybe not the hugging so much, but talking is certainly fine.
Well, you had a hit with New Adventures of Old Christine. You won the mm-hmm. Emmy for Best Actress in a Comedy Series. And this ran for 5 seasons. Elaine Bennis and Christine from New Adventures are both, you know, working women and really kind of insecure. Is there comedy in the insecurity?
Absolutely. There's no comedy in insecurity. And I don't think there's any comedy in things working out well. Conflict is where what's interesting. And I love playing that undercurrent of a lack of confidence. I think I can tap into it very easily. And but yeah, insecurity is great fun.
You know, I have to ask, are you really insecure as an actress? I mean, most people will never have a hit like Seinfeld.
Yes, I am insecure. Of course I am. Who isn't? Who isn't insecure? Can I just say that? Who isn't? And also in showbiz particularly, you know, you sort of, it's kind of an unforgiving business, in case you hadn't noticed. So it's like whatever your last job is, sort of like, is, you know, are you in? Are you out? I mean, it's very fickle and it can be very nasty and, you know. So that plays into the security thing for sure, you know. I mean, I fight it. I try not to give it any credence or anything like that. But, you know, easy come, easy go.
Well, I wish you success with the series. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, it's been great having you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus stars as the vice president in the new HBO series Veep. It airs Sunday at 10. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback. Angie'sList.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, we talk with Stephen Moffat, co-creator and writer of the PBS series Sherlock, about updating Conan Doyle's Great Detective to the modern age. Season 2 of Sherlock premieres Sunday on PBS. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Avengers, the new film directed and written by Joss Whedon based on the Marvel comic book characters. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, TV writer and producer Stephen Moffat, has made a specialty lately of injecting new life into old characters and stories. The creator of the British sitcom Coupling has written and produced recent installments of the Doctor Who series, which is coming up on its golden anniversary. And simultaneously, he and Mark Gatiss have co-created a well-received modern update of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories. Called Sherlock, the series stars Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock and Martin Freeman from the original British version of The Office as Dr. Watson. Season 2 of Sherlock premieres on PBS on Masterpiece Mystery this Sunday. Our TV critic David Biancooley spoke to Stephen Moffat earlier this week. They began with a scene from the new season. Here Sherlock and Dr. Watson are being briefed by the police, one of whom is Sherlock's brother Mycroft, played by the series co-creator Mark Gatiss. They're discussing a new case involving Irene Adler, a dominatrix whose website bears the slogan, "Know When You Are Beaten." Holmes is looking through photos taken from the site.
And I assume this Adler woman has some compromising photographs.
You're very quick, Mr. Holmes.
Hardly a difficult deduction. Photographs of whom?
A person of significance to my employer. We prefer not to say any more at this time.
You can't tell us anything?
I can tell you it's a young person. A young female person.
How many photographs?
A considerable number, apparently.
Do Miss Adler and this young female person appear in these photographs together?
Yes, they do.
And I assume in a number of compromising scenarios.
An imaginative range, we are assured.
John, you might want to put that cup back in its saucer now.
Can you help us, Mr. Holmes?
How?
Will you take the case?
What case? Pay her, now and in full. As Miss Adler remarks in her masthead, know when you are beaten.
She doesn't want anything. She got in touch. She informed us that the photographs existed. She indicated that she had no intention to use them to extort either money or favor.
Oh, a power play. A power play with the most powerful family in Britain. Now, that is a dominatrix. Oh, this is getting rather fun, isn't it?
Sherlock. Where is she?
In London, currently. She's staying...
Text me the details. I'll be in touch by the end of the day. Laters!
That's Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock Holmes in the Masterpiece mystery series Sherlock. Stephen Moffat, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Hello.
There's so many questions I want to ask about this, but let me just start with the fact that rather than hide from the updating and the difficult things that you have to do when updating, which is acknowledge phones, cell phones, and computers and laptops, you embrace it all and use it. Can you talk about that?
Well, the thing about Sherlock Holmes in the original is that he's very, very techno-literate. I mean, to a contemporary Victorian reader, he was a sort of cutting-edge scientist. He was well up with all the stuff. He was also born for the internet age because he loves research. He loves acquiring knowledge. So I just imagine that, you know, the modern Sherlock would be lurking around the chat rooms and the forums and finding out what's going on. Far from being a difficult thing to embrace, it was a joy because he would love it. Also, one of the sort of marvels of it is in the original stories, even once the telephone becomes a possibility for Baker Street, he doesn't really like the telephone. He prefers to send telegrams. Now, what are texts except telegrams? You know, brisk, to the point, with no actual personal contact.
How did you come up with this Sherlock character? I mean, the particular edginess of this version as you had written him and adapted him?
To be honest, I think we did it by going back to the original. I mean, this is Cumberbatch's Holmes is pretty close to the Doyle version. You can find most of those ingredients in the original stories. He seems edgier because we've put him in the modern day. You can sort of put up with Sherlock Holmes's peculiarities when he's distant from you, when he's this sort of historical relic in Victorian London. But put him in the modern day, you think, bloody hell, he's a bit frightening, isn't he? He's a scary man. Wouldn't want to get stuck with him. So that edginess comes just from he's in your face, he's living in your town, and he's living now, and I think that's what makes him scary.
The production style that you have for Sherlock is as high-tech as all of the machines that you feature in it, from laptops to cell phones. And part of it seems sometimes like a graphic novel, but it's always moving fast. It's always going there. Why that production style, and how hard is that to implement?
We always wanted it to be stylish. We didn't want it to be sort of like other television. We wanted to have a filmic sense. Now, everybody says that about the TV show. Everybody always says that. But then my wife Sue got hold of Paul McGuigan to direct it. And he is the one, I think, who brought that that tremendous beauty to it. And one of the very first things he said, having read the scripts and seen the original version of the pilot, was, you want to think Sherlock Holmes is behind the camera too. You want to see the world as Sherlock Holmes sees it. And that informs an awful lot of his work on the show, is to give you the Sherlock's eye view of the world all the time. Uh, and you know, I suppose in some way my answer to this is, you know, get a very, very good director. But he did, and that worked out.
Is it a stretch to think that Sherlock Holmes really does belong on television, because they were originally written, like started with Strand Magazine, as episodic adventures?
Well, this is a really interesting thing, actually. It's not too much of a stretch to say that Arthur Conan Doyle invented the TV series. The reason he came up with the Sherlock Holmes short stories, having already created the character in a couple of novels, was he looked at all the fiction magazines, and they were all serialized novels or short stories. And he sort of picked up a gap in the market. He thought to himself, well, look, the short stories are great, but they don't bring you back next week or next month. The serialized novels are great because they bring you back next month, but if you miss the beginning, you might not want to join in the middle. So he thought, and this is the first time anyone had done this, what about a continual series of short stories featuring the same character? You can start anywhere you like, but you'll always have a reason to come back next month. Now, that is the TV series. So, yes, Sherlock Holmes fits very happily into the medium of television, partly because I think he's the precedent for it.
Our guest is Stephen Moffat, writer and co-creator of the new Sherlock series, returning on Masterpiece Mystery on PBS. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Stephen Moffat, writer and co-creator of the new Sherlock series, returning on Masterpiece Mystery on PBS. I think that in this project in particular, the richness of the casting throughout, not only the writing of the characters, but the casting of the primary roles and then of the secondary roles is so crucial. So talk about that process for a while.
Well, obviously, number one is Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes. There are very, very few people who can play Sherlock Holmes, and there have been so many and so few good ones. Mm-hmm. That's the truth. You've got, you know, the mighty Basil Rathbone, the mighty Jeremy Brett, and a few others. And there's just not that many who transcend the role and actually change the role. So we were very, very aware of getting that the modern day Sherlock Holmes is going to be hell. And after he'd read for it and we taped it, we just said, well, look, there is really no point in us looking anywhere else. There just isn't.
And I have to say, one of the best names of all time.
And it's real. Yes. That's his name. Benedict Cumberbatch is actually his actual real name. I know. Isn't it great? How often is Sherlock Holmes played by someone with an even stupider name?
It's
Sorry,
wonderful.
Sorry, Benedict, if you're listening.
Now, and then,
it's a great name.
And then Martin Freeman, whom some but not enough American listeners would know as one of the stars of the original British version of The Office.
What we had to do there was we had to find someone who would be the ideal other half, because if you look at the stories, you look at any good version of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson is every bit as important a character as Sherlock Holmes, and some would argue more so, because he's our conduit to Sherlock Holmes. He's the person to whom the story in a way happens. We are more emotionally resonant with Dr. Watson than we are with Sherlock Holmes, because Sherlock Holmes is, you know, a hard man to empathise with. So what we did was we auditioned an awful lot of people. Bizarrely, one of the very first person we auditioned for Dr. Watson was Matt Smith, who we later cast, a few weeks later, cast as Doctor Who. And we got a bunch of really, really good people to come in, and we thought, well, let's get them all in to read with Benedict and see if magic happens with one of them. And I have to say, brilliant though they all were, and they all were brilliant, the moment Benedict and Martin were in the same room, you just thought, well, there it is. That's it. It's sorted.
Well, here's an example of that chemistry from the first season of programs. Benedict Cumberbatch as Holmes, Martin Freeman as Watson, and they're discussing Watson's chronicling of Holmes' adventures. And I love this, that he's not doing it in articles that he did in the original short stories, but on a blog. So let's play it and then talk about it.
So you've written up the taxi driver case?
Yes.
A study in pink. Nice.
Well, you know, pink lady, pink case, pink phone. There was a lot of pink.
Did you like it?
No. Why not? I thought you'd be flattered.
Flattered? Sherlock sees through everything and everyone in seconds. What's incredible, though, is how spectacularly ignorant he is about some things.
Now, hang on a minute. I didn't mean that in a...
Oh, you meant spectacularly ignorant in a nice way. Look, it doesn't matter to me who's prime minister or who's sleeping with who.
Or that the Earth goes around the sun.
Oh, yeah. God, that again. It's not important.
Not important. It's primary school stuff. How can you not know that?
But if I ever did, I've deleted it.
Deleted it?
Listen. This is my hard drive, and it only makes sense to put things in there that are useful. Really useful. Ordinary people fill their heads with all kinds of rubbish, and that makes it hard to get at the stuff that matters, do you see?
But it's the solar system!
Oh, hell, what does that matter? So we go around the sun, or we went around the moon, or round and round the garden like a teddy bear. It wouldn't make any difference. All that matters to me is the work. Without that, my brain rots. Put that in your blog. Or better still, stop inflicting your opinions on the world.
That was Benedict Cumberbatch as Holmes, Martin Freeman as Watson. All right. What in that scene captures the essence that you wanted to capture of those two characters?
Well, I think that's a very lovely scene written by Mark Gatiss. And it combines two moments from our study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four, actually, about Sherlock's very peculiar attitude to learning. I love the idea that Sherlock Holmes gives bad reviews to Watson's stories. That's from the original.
Uh-huh.
Is that every time you read a Sherlock Holmes story at the beginning of the run in particular, Sherlock Holmes is saying, well, last week was terrible. You know, you've been an absolute hash of that. And just the pleasant exasperation between the two of them, the domesticity, the sense of a friendship conveyed by the fact that they'd never have to be kind to each other. They have absolute confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine those conversations rolling on and on into the night.
We're speaking with Stephen Moffat, who is redoing Sherlock Holmes stories for television now, and also tackled another iconic character for television, Doctor Who. Explain what Doctor Who is, you know, in general, before we get into this specific.
Okay. Well, Doctor Who is a grand old British tradition, and actually, in my view, the best television series of all time. The format is incredibly simple. It's a human-looking alien who can travel in a machine called the TARDIS to anywhere in time and space. He's called the Doctor. He travels about. We don't know a lot about him or where he came from, so the show is called Doctor Who. And where he meets people, he helps them. He rides into town like Shane, never quite explains who he is, saves everybody and rides out again, though in his case, generally speaking, survives. The part has been played by a number of different actors because the Doctor has the ability, when he's injured or dying, to sort of rebirth himself, to regenerate into a new physical form and really a completely different character as the Doctor. It's been running for nearly 50 years in the UK with a slight gap. And if you haven't sampled it so far, it is a joy awaiting you.
Well, let's play a clip with Matt Smith as the Doctor, Karen Gillan, who was going to become his new companion, Amy Pond, and in the opening episode of this particular series, he visits her in childhood, and she gives him an apple with a face on it, and then he says he'll be back in 5 minutes, and he returns 12 years later. And this is the scene when he's trying to convince her that he is who he was.
I'm the Doctor. I'm a time traveler. Everything I told you 12 years ago is true. I'm real. What's happening in the sky is real. And if you don't let me go right now, everything you've ever known is over.
I don't believe you.
Just 20 minutes. Just believe me for 20 minutes. Look at it. Fresh as the day you gave it to me, and you know it's the same one. Amy, believe for 20 minutes.
What do we do?
Stop that nurse.
That's Karen Gillan as Amy Pond and Matt Smith as the Doctor. And again, I listen to these clips and I watch what's going on, and I think that casting is so key. How central is that to how you create a show and then how you and your staff write it for them?
Well, you know, everything else about a show, other than the casting, other than the central actors, however great it is, however admirable and accomplished and excellent it is, can only ever really sort of be admired. People don't have a relationship with great writing or great production or great art direction or great direction. They just sort of admire it. What people fall in love with, oddly enough, is other people. So the difference between a beautifully made failure and a beautifully made hit is who you've got playing the leads. Now, in the case of Matt Smith as the Doctor, I'd been very, very adamant that we'd have an older Doctor, that he'd be in his 40s. I wasn't going to have any young Doctors on my watch. And on the very, very first day of auditions, he was the third one through the door. Any fool would have cast him. It was dead easy. And you just think, well, God. And I remember asking, what age is he? I was 26, and he was just instantly the perfect Doctor, because he does do that thing of combining the old man and the young man. As I keep saying, he looks like a young man assembled by old men from memory.
Oh, well, both of your productions of Doctor Who and Sherlock, I've noticed, are about like brilliant loners who are accompanied by single loyal companions, and in the Doctor Who series especially, you've written very often and very well from the point of view of outcasts and lonely kids. What was your childhood like?
Well, I'm a geek. I'm a writer. I spent all my time in my childhood obsessing about Sherlock Holmes and Doctor Who. I was alone. I was an outsider. What do you expect? I was that bullied kid at the back of the class, weeping for loneliness. I mean, I don't think, generally speaking, people become writers because they were the really cool, attractive kid in class. I'll be honest. Sorry, other writers, but we weren't, were we? Come on. So I was a bit like that, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, that makes it sound far too wretched and sad. It wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
A hero is quite often our loners. You very rarely have. Bizarrely enough, heroes who are sort of with a huge peer group, do you? I mean, even James Bond, who hasn't got the slightest reason to be alone, is, you know, you'd think he'd be a popular guy, but no. He lives his life alone with a succession of very beautiful women, so that probably helps out.
I think that you have cast Sherlock perfectly, but my question is, after we're seeing season two now in the States, after season three, I'm wondering if you're going to be able to keep your stars of Sherlock, because Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman are both big stars in the two new Hobbit movies. So
yes, but we have their families trapped in a cellar. they are both, I can honestly say, very, very keen to carry on with Sherlock as it stands. Things we do a limited amount of Sherlock. That's the way we do it every year or so. We get together and do three movies. So you are free to do other things. And I think it'll do them both good to descend from their mighty star status in LA and New Zealand and get back in a small caravan in Wales and make some more Sherlock.
Stephen Moffat, thank you for being on Fresh Air.
Pleasure.
Stephen Moffat speaking with David Biancooley. Moffat is co-creator of the PBS series Sherlock. Its second season premieres on Masterpiece Mystery this Sunday. David Biancooley teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey and is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film, The Avengers. This is Fresh Air. In the comic book series The Avengers, Marvel brought together some of its famous superheroes to fend off intergalactic threats. The characters, Iron Man, the Hulk, Thor, and Captain America, has each had his own blockbuster movie or movies, and they now unite in what, on the basis of advanced ticket sales, promises to be a huge hit. The Avengers is written and directed by Joss Whedon and will be shown in some theaters in 3D. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Two spheres merge in The Avengers, the Marvel Comics universe and the Whedonverse, fans name for the nerdy, wisecracking, existentialist superhero world of writer-director Joss Whedon. The Whedon cult is smaller, but maybe more fervent, inspiring academic conferences on such subjects as free will versus determinism in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I find a lot of Whedon's banter self-consciously smart-alecky, but I love how he can spoof his subjects without robbing them of stature. For Whedon, the heart of the Avengers clearly isn't the predictable whiz-bang computer-generated battles between good and evil, but scenes in which our superheroes hang out, spar with words as well as weapons, and weigh the merits of individualism versus teamwork. It's not unlike Howard Hawks's iconic gunfighters taking one another's measure in Rio Bravo. And it's fun to watch Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man, say to Bruce Banner, a.k.a. the Hulk, something like, "Hey, Banner, come see the nifty stuff in my lab." And Banner say, "Sounds good, Stark. See you later, Captain. Bye, Thor." And I'm like, "That's so cool." Okay, I'm geeking out, too. I had a blast at The Avengers. For the uninitiated, I know there are a few of you, The Avengers are a collective of four male Marvel superheroes. Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr., with a heavy dose of CGI. Captain America, played by Chris Evans. Thor, which is Chris Hemsworth in Norse getup. And the gigantic lime green Hulk, a special effect with Mark Ruffalo as its human alter ego. We also get a female hero played by Scarlett Johansson, Natasha Romanoff, a.k.a. Black Widow, who doesn't get as much fan attention because she's not supernaturally or scientifically enhanced, but whom Whedon gives a ton of screen time. They've been called together by one-eyed superhero wrangler Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson, to save the Earth after Thor's adopted brother Loki hurtles through a space portal from the mythical realm of Asgard. Loki thinks deep down humans long to follow orders and boasts he will, quote, free the world from freedom. As played by Tom Hiddleston, Loki is a magnificently theatrical presence and easily outglowers Downey's snide Stark when dropping by unexpectedly.
What have I to fear?
The Avengers. That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team. Earth's mightiest heroes type thing.
Yes, I've met them.
Yeah. Takes us a while to get any traction, I'll give you that one. But let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod, a super soldier, a living legend who kind of lives up to the legend, a man with breathtaking anger management issues, a couple of master assassins, and you, big fella, you've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
Not a great plan. When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
Oh, I thought the Beast had won that off.
You're missing the point. There's no throne. There is no version of this where you come out on top. Maybe your army comes, and maybe it's too much for us, but it's all on you. Because if we can't protect the Earth, you can be damn well sure we'll avenge it.
Downey fares least well in The Avengers, being obnoxious beyond the call of duty. But it's not all his fault. The part has taken a weird turn. For some reason, Whedon has Stark haranguing Banner not to suppress the Hulk, but let that giant, wildly destructive part of himself out, as if their flying battleship were some kind of est seminar. Fortunately, Ruffalo's Banner shrugs it off. The actor is sly and shambling and attractively mussed and steals every scene by underplaying. That's not the only conflict. The Avengers drive one another so loco, it's a wonder they get to Loki. They pick fights. Captain America's shield fending off Thor's hammer. Thor's hammer smashing Iron Man's suit. Iron Man's suit deflecting Hulk's fist. Nobody wins, but trees and man-made structures lose. As I watched, I thought, wow, that must have cost a lot of money. But it's not just money on the screen. The frames have the zing of good comic book illustrations, and Whedon picks his moments to come at you with 3D, a spear here and there tickling your nostril hairs. Multiple protagonists means by the time you've had your fill of snotty Iron Man, you get the over-earnest Captain America, and when you're bored with the Captain, you get the Norse hottie. Always something to see. Along with Ruffalo's Hulk, it's Johansson's Black Widow who's the biggest treat, her deadpan prickling with rage and hurt. Whedon never lets us forget that, in the words of one government bureaucrat, the fate of the human race has been left to a handful of freaks. Prepare yourself, Earthlings. For the next few weeks, we'll all be living in the Whedonverse.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Anne Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school at wallacefoundation.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise of Hitler through the eyes of an American ambassador and his daughter. Eric Larson's book In the Garden of Beasts is about William Dodd, who became ambassador to Germany in 1933. His daughter had an affair with the first head of the Gestapo. Larson's book is now out in paperback. Join us.